This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. Maria Lisella is here. She's very active in her community. She's really busy making things happen. But first and foremost, she's a poet. And so she's going to come at us with a poem. Here's Maria.
Cornrows. Cheryl's cornrows are a maze of braids that crisscross her round head, topping her dark Trinidadian neck. Her mother jelly coats her coffee-colored fingers to move rapid and sure through nappy, crinkled hair. She pulls one rope of hair over the other, over the other, over the other, until the braids are locked down tight with barrettes, ribbons, and bows. Around the corner at Jean's Beauty Parlor, white women plop into wide leather chairs as metallic chemicals crimp and whip their soft hair into prim Tootsie Roll curls. Across the street, Sylvia's is cramped, arm to shiny bronze arm, with black women pressing their hair, making it straight, 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 shiny, smooth as seals, take the nap out. Cheryl and I watch Angela Davis, who never lived in Queens, the land of smooth and straight, cry out of the TV. She raises her fist past a brazen halo of naturally kinky hair, letting her fro fly loud and free, as if her hair said, "I will not hide. I am trouble. See me now." Cheryl's cornrows, a puzzle of braids, locked down tight, tight, tight. I touch my smooth hair, a single rope down my spine, wishing all the while best friends could look more alike.
That is so beautiful. Maria Lisella, what book is that from?
That book, that cornrows, I think, is only...
That an early book?
It is an early book. I'm ashamed to say I haven't published a book in a while. I keep making them, but not getting them published.
For other people, you mean?
Kind of crazy. And I make them for other people. That is in Thieves in the Family, which is my New York Quarterly book.
You know, Maria, that is a picture of Queens, isn't it? Queens, New York, where you were raised and born. What would you have to say about that community?
Well, that community is peculiar because it's Southeast Queens. And it's almost a forgotten part of Queens in the sense that the roads haven't been expanded. There's very little public transportation. It doesn't actually reflect the ethnicity of Queens.
But what was it like when you were growing up?
When I was growing up, that was pretty much an African-American neighborhood. And there were two families that were not African-American. My own, my aunt's down the block, and actually my mother's friend who owned the beauty parlor around the
corner.
I love
that. Beauty parlor, because it is a microcosm of your life there, and it shows such unanimity that one wishes everyone could have grown up in that circumstance. Don't you agree?
Yeah, it's true, because people, even people who left the neighborhood, they would always come back to Jean's Beauty Parlor to get their hair.
That is so great.
I mean, as if she was doing something different than everyone else. She probably wasn't. It was a one-woman, you know, beauty parlor.
Yeah, but she was bringing people together. The races were together. The white people sat and waited for their turn. And it was just, I believe that that is like a crystal of your life. So I'm so glad you let off with that. Let's have another.
Yeah, I just want to say that Sylvia's and Jean's, they were actually right around the corner from each other. The black women went to the other one because they had different chemicals and different processing. And Jean's was the other one. But they were all doing kind of similar things to their hair.
Hair.
Hair is such a big thing.
Let's have another poem and see who Maria really is.
Okay, let's see. I actually like to read, I'd like to read Our Date. And I'm going to read it from New Verse News because they published it. They were the first ones to publish it. And I really appreciated that. The editor is James Pena, and he's got a very broad sensibility. So this is called Our Date. My stepson spent the afternoon in detention for lying to a nun. I told them my name means pheasants in Italian, but no one believed me. half white, half Puerto Rican, Italian last name, nappy hair, and said otherwise. At the perfect age of 10, my stepson and I had a date one afternoon. Determined to teach him to fly, forget nuns, divorced parents, overprotective mother, or just ride a bike, a two-wheeler, banana seat, shiny, chrome, bells, streamers. He'd run alongside it, throw one leg far and wide in time to find the pedal on the other side. I clutched the back of the seat, sent him off as far as I could, like my father did for me, knowing spills and harm would follow. Years later, a knot in my heart, his dusty, tear-smeared face, lips quivering, telling me of a quick ride to Pelham Bay, where he was chased down by taunts of, "You don't belong here." I tried to tell them my name, but no one listened. I think of all I don't know about courage, how to build it, pass it on, when to fight, when to flee, and when to leave your bike behind, save your life, just find your way home.
When to leave your bike behind, something we all need to know. You had a beautiful marriage and you were a wonderful stepmother. That name doesn't do justice to the role you played. But what was your literary association with Gill? Tell us a little bit about Gill.
Okay, so Gill and I met when I was pretty young. I was around 23, and he was kind of a mysterious guy because he was very shy, quiet. But I knew he was a single dad, and he always had the kids with him. We got together, partly, I determined to meet him. It was very funny. It was years later, I was at a demonstration, and a friend of mine said, "Oh, remember that guy, Gill? He's having a party." And I was living with my sister, and I said, "We have to go to the Bronx." So we did. And so essentially what happened with Gill was we went through a lot of different stages, like many couples. We were a little older. I was 35 when I got married, and he already had a marriage and two kids. But he was really some sort of a work in progress, but he was the one working on it. I actually didn't look at him as a project, the project adoption, you know. But he was already on his way. He was writing journals probably since the 60s. He didn't start writing. He started writing poetry in his 50s, I think, and he learned Italian at 50. We were very interested in exploring our ethnicity, but we were also ashamed of some of our ethnicity because it was always linked to very right-wing situations, and neither of us were in that category. So we looked for, you know, kind of left-wing or progressive Italian-Americans, that included Vito Marcantonio and Antonio Gramsci, who he was already reading. And so we kind of put together a little bit of a curriculum for ourselves to learn about Italian-Americans we could identify with. How's that? Isn't that funny?
That is fabulous.
And then out of that, we went to Sicily for our honeymoon, and that was the first time he went to Italy. He met his family. But he didn't learn Italian right away. When he was about 50, we went to Abruzzo, and he knew he had family there, but somebody wasn't speaking to someone. And we were there with my parents, and he met his relatives who were connected to two poets and a dramatist. So he got all these books that they gave him, some of which were in dialect. And then he found Luigi Bonafini at Brooklyn College, who was an expert in those kinds of dialects. So Gill decided he really wanted to learn Italian in earnest. And he learned it well enough, actually, to translate other people's poems. And what I did find that I either had not remembered or didn't know about, his first poems he published in America Oggi, Italian America Oggi. And they were in Italian, and they were about alcoholism. And I never remembered reading those poems in English. And it was really fascinating to me because he had been through drug addiction and alcohol addiction.
But he was a psychologist, as I remember.
Well, he was a psychotherapist. And he did eventually become director of the substance abuse program in Brooklyn.
But what interested me the most was your affiliation as literary titans, if you will. And I think you're still working on a manuscript which involves him. Is that right?
Yes. 6 months after he died, he was still in the hospital when his book, Missing Madonnas, was accepted. It was in March. He passed away in April. So he never saw the cover. Nick Grosso did a gorgeous cover. And the book came out in October. And I was really able to shepherd that book. The second book is a bilingual book. And I just collapsed, I think, for a whole year. And I couldn't handle it. So now that's in its last stages. And it's called Soundtrack of a Life.
And how are you involved with that?
I'm kind of just doing a few things like doing a second reading or a proofing, because Luigi is really handling the whole thing. He translated it. And so he just asked me to do a last look before we send it to the publisher.
Well, before we go back to your own poetry, I just want to honor the memory of Gil, because he was a force in Italian literature in America. And the fact that you're keeping his spirit and his work alive is a tribute. And I want to thank you for that. And now we want to hear a poem which brings us back to the heart and soul of Maria Lasella.
Okay. I picked out a couple of things.
Are they from books?
They're not all published. This one, We is posted, I think Red Wheelbarrow Poets published this. This is called We. Like that day in February, crisp, sharp, cloudless. It's like that today, when winter refuses to fade. The sheets over and under you, creaseless like the sky. I bend over your hospital bed, release the railing between us. In silence, we call mercy into the room.
Mm.
He and I had a situation where we had a folder on the table all the time called Scambio. Right? Exchange. And we would put our drafts of poems in there. And we would each visit that and do something or make suggestions whenever, you know, we could. And so he was my first reader for everything. This is kind of a nice poem. This, it kind of goes with that one, if I should read it.
I'd love it. I'd love that.
It's from Shrew, which was a journal that was put out by students at Binghamton. Anointing. As the winter sky cools on its way tonight, you ask me, before you go, can you? And I do. Unwilling to go, needing to go, I organize items on the table, as if anointing them for you, talk you through the maze of meds, the need to eat something, anything, all day. I swirl and spin the hospital furniture, the walker, the tables into place. Your prayer books next to the phone, small laboratory cups of mouthwashes for who remembers why there are three. I make my way to Second Avenue, chase the subway car, look up to see a woman giggling. I must have missed a transient funny incident on the platform. She wants me to join her. I do. I smile back, blink, and recall the last thing you asked. Would you take a hot cloth, wash my face, as my grandmother did on cold mornings, knowing each child would tiptoe on chilled wooden planked floors, as my mother did for me, to gentle me into mornings.
Mm.
I reach my stop, and I think quite possibly, I forgot to warm your face as night falls in a place where the weather never changes, where you live just for me.
Mm. Mm. No greater love. I really cherish the idea of your mother warming your face in a cold apartment with a hot washcloth, so that when you got up, she eased you into the morning. What a beautiful thing. And he, it was eased into eternity. Though I have the names of your books and I've read them: Thieves in the Family, Amore on Hope Street, Two Naked Feet. And what would you say is a constant theme in all of these books? Who is Maria?
Good question.
What is it?
It's funny because most of my work, I don't use the letter I, you know, the word I. I'm comfortable in the background. I mean, it's not to say that I'm not coming through these poems, but.
You don't think you're in the landscape of these poems?
I think I am, but I'm not.
It's not all about you.
Yeah, it's not all in the foreground. I actually try to find a certain amount of specificity, but not too much.
Well, let me just say, is it you're Italian-American growing up in South Jamaica? Is that one of the themes? Is it your love and your marriage? Is that another theme? Is your activism a theme? Is it historicity, your Italian heritage? I think all that's in there.
I think all of those are filters. And I think the one theme I've deliberately focused on recently is mental illness, because my two stepsons are mentally ill. And I think I've tried to write about them in a way to show their humanity, not their stigma as mentally ill people, but people who have dreams and people who have wishes, and they may go unfulfilled, but they have them nevertheless. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about mentally ill people. There's a lot of fear about them. People think they're very unpredictable. I think most of the time they tend to be more passive than so unpredictable. But I understand the fear. And they're all grouped in now with homeless people, and no one knows which is which, and no one knows which is a criminal and which is a family that just needs a home, and who really needs care. So they're very, it's kind of a population that is almost invisible, except when they get in the way.
Let's hear your work. Do you have a poem about that?
I do.
Are they living on their own, Gil's sons?
No, they one is in a facility. They'll probably never leave.
But they're taken care of. They're taken care of.
Well, one is. The other one is living in a shelter because he's very stubborn.
Isn't this a great American? America is tainted with this, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tainted with a certain unkindness toward those who cannot take care of themselves.
That's a good way.
My father used to say, "The big sin in America is to be poor." And you're not patriotic unless you're in debt up to your ears, which my parents never were. So I think he said, I think people think I'm unpatriotic. But this is kind of a recent poem. It hasn't been published yet. And it came to me one day when I was having a coffee. A lot of things come to me over coffee. What I'd want for you. This is not the poem about when you die, but when you fly. I catch the flash of a slim child. His cape of dreadlocks, lifted by the wind around his shoulders, takes my breath away. For a nanosecond, it is you, navigating through traffic, a dancer on a skateboard as you once were, darting in and out and under steel girders that buttress Queens and the Bronx. Or a skater on the icy mirror at Rockefeller Center, a straight-backed flyer, an at-ease child, someone's child, who feels freedom on their legs, strong as tree trunks, small waist pivots, dodges, ducks, 16-wheeler trucks, buses, cars, scooters, fellow skateboarders, glides through the traffic, life, fearless, untroubled by the urban cacophony of car horns blasting, bullets sailing past your earlobe, your wrist, but it isn't you, can't be you, now that you are living in the space of darkness and delusion. Inside a room, you circle where it is always night, making music, memorizing stories, singing to yourself, recording your voice for no one, plotting to move to the Greek islands, Italy. Yesterday it was Japan. And why would I think twice about the plant to move across an ocean or two, like the urban pigeons that are not indigenous to New York, fire escapes, subways, and telephone poles? You'd breeze out of the Bronx as they did from North Africa, the Mediterranean to alight here for an accidental diaspora. And didn't they fare well enough?
Wow, what a good last line. You were the first poet laureate of Queens.
And I'm actually the sixth.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, sorry.
You were the most visible one. You're the only one I knew. You were on television all the time. Really, I'm telling you.
I was very lucky.
You were hot. What were some of the projects you did?
Well, the main project was really just to be as close to the public as possible. And so I used the Queen's libraries because it was 65 branches of them. So I did a lot of readings and I invited people all over the place to read out loud. We read at festivals. We just read. I mean, I didn't really come up with like a fancy technical thing to do. I had an idea and I sort of abandoned it because it just seemed so complicated. And I thought it was more important just to get out there and be public.
Well,
and then, more recently, I started doing workshops in the last 3 years. And that has been really wonderful because I've had, because they're free and they're public, we would get an incredible cross-section of people. And that included, there was one person from Ukraine who used to come every week, a person from a mental facility. He would dial in from his own. I had people say they hadn't written for 20 years, and since they had been diagnosed bipolar. So my essential feeling was to create a safe space for them. And
you did. You gave voice to so many in the past few years, along with your work with the Italian American Association. So right. You've been really very active in that discrete place, but universally other places as well. So yeah. What is your new role now with Bordighera Press? And first of all, tell us what the press is.
So Bordighera Press was started about the same time as Italian American Writers Association, about 31 years ago. Going on 32. And it was started by Anthony Tamburi, Paolo Giordano, and Fred Gardafe. I think essentially they were looking to create a home, in particular for Italian American writers. Not to create a ghetto, but many Italian American writers had been going to Guernica Press, which was in Canada. And they were able to, they get somewhat of a subsidy to function. Whereas from their government, they get some government support, whereas we don't. And I think that's how Bordighera was actually started. Now there seem to be a million things that Bordighera does. When you go to the website, they have all kinds of awards and prizes and folio and different sections of it. So my role is a small role, actually. I'm taking Peter Covino's place as poetry editor. He was the poetry editor for 13 years.
Is this for the book
Via?
Oh, Via the magazine.
The magazine.
Okay. So that's one more thing on your plate. But before we let you go into the world where you're so active, I want to get more poetry. Give us another poem, and then I want to hear about your world as a travel writer.
Okay.
Give us a poem.
Let's see. I'll do a short one. I'm in a few groups, which helps me to keep pumping things out.
It does help.
It was written by from a prompt. The clouds rolled in, or what rolled out when the clouds rolled in. That was the prompt. Do tell me what you did inside the time the clouds rolled in that foggy Thursday. What did you think between their arrival and their scattering to make way for a sliver of sunshine to stream across the sky in a distant alien metallic light so hard to name? How many breaths had you taken in between the clouds' arrival? Were they slow? Did you see peacocks or angels in the formations? What were you thinking in between this shift of nature, seemingly so unnatural, so cinematographic, so without cause or wind or breeze, as if a guest on an unnamed day in spring ushered in waves of unrequited weather shifts? No romance or order, just change, rather than a stilling of the moment, Fractured thoughts, none to catch, grapple to the ground, editing the present to make way for the future, in your heart, in the sky. A battle cry for your mind, for the minute you decide to hide in the house behind a long list of shoulds, behind accusations. What were you thinking on that Thursday when the sky broke in silver ribbons, promising nothing as the red moon rose, the sun is eclipsed, and we are no longer speaking?
Oh, the lyrical Maria. I want everyone to know all about you before we go any further. And we have said you've had 3 books of poetry published, and that you're curating the Italian American Writers Association Literary Series, and you're a charter member of Brevitas, which is an online poetry venue, and you're an award-winning travel writer. Now, when I first met you years ago, you were very active as a travel writer. How did that begin? I know you even taught journalism, and you've taught, oh my gosh, you've taught tourism, you've taught English. But your background is really interesting as a poet and a publisher and an editor, but as a travelogue writer. How did that start, and where did you go? How many places did you go?
I went to 62 countries. I counted that one day. That was amazing. I was bouncing around in publishing and not really finding, I didn't really have a pedigree journalism degree. So that closed a lot of doors. So I just kept bumping around publications that no one had ever heard of. I tried public relations. I did a lot of different things. And then I got a part-time job fact-checking at Travel and Leisure. And that job turned into a full-time job. And American Express had a wonderful, generous program where they paid for your master's degree if you wanted to go to college to get another degree. And I wanted to go to Columbia or NYU for journalism. I always felt like I needed that that sort of like reinforcement as to who I was or what my career would be. And I couldn't get in because they were both full-time, and I didn't want to quit my job, which my sister Julia always says, that's kind of a typical blue-collar mistake. You should quit your job and borrow the money, but we never thought of things. So I went to NYU, which is now NYU Polytech, at night school, and I got a journalism degree, and I felt a little more confident about what I was doing. And then I switched from the glamorous Travel and Leisure to a travel trade publication, which is essentially a business publication. They paid twice as much, you traveled, and it opened an enormous world to me. And I would say that I'm still doing some of it, but during the pandemic, nobody was going anywhere. But I do write for a couple of outlets. I write for La Voce de New York, cultural things, and also for Never Stop Traveling, which is a terrific website. But what happened with the travel was I kind of used it as, you know, I had deadlines, and so I put all my energy into the magazine. What I did also, I did outtakes from the articles. I would talk to the guide after hours. I would talk to the general manager after hours, over wine or whatever. And that's where I got all these travel pieces that are in my publications. I can give you one if you want. It's kind of an old one.
Well, you are known for your human interest. So now you're giving us the background of how you accomplished that. So you did your diligent duty for your magazine, but then in off hours, you really got down with the people.
Then I was able to talk to people about where they were and what how they felt when the Berlin Wall fell or whatever.
And are you going to go back to traveling?
I hope so. I mean, I just came back from the first trip in a couple of years, in 3 years, actually.
Where did you go?
I went to Prague to visit Bill's cousins. And then I went to France. I stayed in a village of only 18 people. A friend of mine invited me. She goes to this place. She's been going there for 35 years. It was the most gorgeous trip. I wasn't doing Wi-Fi. I didn't, it was funny. The first couple of days was really shocking without that.
Without communication.
Yeah, because I realized how much I spend time texting. And
but Maria, did you write it up? Have you written up France?
Are no, I haven't written anything about it yet. I mean, I've written a lot of things, but I didn't write anything public yet. So I think I wrote one thing about the cows, but it's kind of a grisly poem. But it was, I mean, I walk up every day at dawn, and at night I had this big skylight, so I had the sky in my room. It was really breathtaking, and it was a great rest.
So would you say you've had a life well lived?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had a wonderful life, and I still do, but I'm still feeling not whole since Gil left.
I know that.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
I do, but your poetry has been another kind of companion, and we do want a final poem.
Okay, you know what? I might give you a silly one. I don't know. Somebody said to me once, leave them laughing. And I thought, really? But I don't know if it's so laughing, but it is a little bit funny. And it is take on grief. This is called My Junk. My husband is crazy, even in death. I walk into his room to file something, and I hear him say, when are you going to get rid of my junk? I respond as I often do to such prompts in the dark. First, it's not your junk. And guess what? Now it's my junk. He laughs, his lunatic laugh, and says, I guess it is. He kept laughing as I closed the door. His cousin says, if Gil is crazy, he's crazy like a fox. If his junk makes you cry for too long, he wants you to get rid of it. His junk inspires you to greater heights. He wants you to keep it a little longer. If his junk is in your way, he wants you to get rid of it. If his junk makes you feel more connected to him, how could he not want that?
Oh, the voice of Maria Lisella. This is the program, The Poet and the Poem, from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. And the program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, by Natalie Canavore, and by Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.